Welcome to Lecture 2 of Exploration 1. I'm going to do Lecture 1, Lecture 2 stuff this semester like I did last year because sometimes the chapters overlap and it can be a little bit of a challenge to figure out what we are doing each lecture, especially when they overlap. Now, question 1. Has anybody pre-read chapter 2 of the curriculum? Sabahattin has a, what's the word? Excuse. Has anybody else pre-read chapter 2 yet? Oh, good. Okay, well, unfortunately, you don't get extra lollipops for 3 and 4, because, you know, we've got a lollipop shortage, so. Alright. Before I get started on the lecture proper, does anybody have any questions or queries on Chapter 1's material? Yes, I have labs from Mike. Yes, I have labs from Char. Yes, I have a couple of Exploration 1 labs sitting in my inbox that will get marked in short order. But does anybody have any questions or queries about Chapter 1 or the course or the content in general? So we either have two situations here. Either nobody's confused, or I've really managed to bamboozle you all in the first lecture. Alrighty.
I'm still
touching. Yeah, no, that's fine. Seriously, if you don't understand the stuff in the first couple of modules, Sabahattin, I'm a little concerned, given what I know of your past history. Okie dokie. Sorry, I wasn't ignoring you all. I was just getting to the right portion of my notes. So, we're continuing on with the end part of Chapter 1, which talks about the difference between circuit-switched and packet-switched networks. Now, for something completely different, can any of you tell me what a circuit... Oh, names into chat, by the way, in case this gets disorderly. Which means... Okay, that's probably not fair on Sabahattin, but if nobody's put their name in chat in 5 seconds, we'll let him have a shot at it. That's how we'll deal with that, because there's no chat window on the iPhone. Can anybody tell me what a circuit switch network is? Does anybody know? Yes, Mike, what's a circuit switch network?
Well, a circuit switch network is a connection between two people which is continuous. It doesn't go through a third party. It just goes down to the exchange and then gets directly connected to the receiver, and it suffers a weakness that if a circuit breaks at any point, then you lose the connection and the message gets lost, and we have to reconnect and do it all over again.
And you'd agree that probably a good example of a circuit switch network would be the classical plain old telephone system, the old one, say, prior to 1990.
Yeah, plain old telephone pots is the horrible clicky dialy thing that we all had blue boxes for.
Absolutely, except blue boxes didn't work in Australia because they separated the signalling across onto a different control network. Which was a bit of a pain, because I would have loved to have been able to make free phone calls. Not that I condone that behaviour, anybody. But anyway, if you don't know what a blue box is, go look it up on Wikipedia. Well, in a way, we have significantly cheaper phone calls with things like Skype and stuff now. And I noticed that a small percentage of our student population doesn't enjoy Skype interface and is quite vocal about it. I assume that quite a larger population of our students doesn't enjoy Skype and is less vocal about it. No, if you do want to know what a blue box is, I'm sure there's an article on Wikipedia that will tell you all about it. I had dreams of building one back in the mid-90s until I discovered that the signalling technology in Australia was actually separated out. So, circuit switch networks. When you open up a call to somebody or when you open up a conversation with somebody, switching logic opens up a physical circuit to from source to destination, whether that goes through exchanges or however that travels. You have your conversation, and then when you hang up the call, the circuit is released. And as I said, one of the problems with that, as Mike has pointed out, is if the circuit gets broken, you lose your call. Also, there is a finite amount of circuit capacity. I don't want to embarrass anybody too much, but is anybody... Oh, why not? Is anybody here old enough to remember manual telephone exchanges? We had one up until 1990 in our little country town.
Yeah, Stroja Bar, I believe that's what they were called, exchanges. And sorry, all our circuits are busy.
Yes, and if you actually went into the exchange, there was actually a patchboard of cables, and when a call came in on one of the incoming lines, you would actually pull the incoming line cord up out of the board, and you'd patch one end into one point of the patch board, and they're actually on these sort of spring-loaded really things, a bit like garden hose, and you'd plug the jack in, and then you'd connect, and that would connect the incoming line into the patch board. I don't know whether anybody's seen that stuff. It's all rather retro, but though, interesting thing, and you'd hold down the when you actually wanted to make a call, you'd have one of those magneto-style phones, and you'd hold the receiver down and give the handle a couple of winds to trip the ringer at the exchange, and then they would pick up the call, and they would then put you through to whoever you wanted to talk to. Interesting system, not particularly efficient, certainly wouldn't scale these days. Very useful, though, as far as the gossip network was concerned. Everybody knew your business. Everybody knew what you were up to. You could ring the exchange and go, does anyone know where Mum is? And the exchange people would track her down for you. It was quite awesome in that way. Yes. And it was also useful because... It depends on the exchange. I don't think we classically got a busy signal unless you made a trunk call and they actually patched it through and you actually heard the sounds coming from the other one. I remember one of the things that a friend of mine was saying was that one of his friends, yeah, it's one of those friend of a friend story, used to go on business trips and he used to have to tell the manual exchange people not to listen in on particular phone calls because he was using a modem, and the woman picking up the phone and saying, "Getting through," would do all sorts of numbers on his 300 board connection to his bulletin board system that he was logged onto. Alrighty. So, circuit switch networks. Now, yeah, you can. There was sufficient quality to get it through the exchange. But then again, you see all these amateurs do all sorts of things with packet radio that I wouldn't dream of doing. So, you know, there's certainly people out there willing to explore the fringe edges of technology and see what is possible and what is feasible and what will actually work. And, yeah, this guy actually had an acoustic coupler because they didn't have the right wiring. So, I don't know whether anybody's watched War Games or listened to War Games, you stick the suction cups onto the mouthpiece and earpiece of the phone and do your connecting. So that was one way of doing it. I think War Games had an acoustic coupler in it. Basically... when they were looking at making these networks scale and when they were looking at making these networks more efficient and more effective, they were looking at how to make these systems more fault-tolerant and more robust. And one of the things that they looked at doing was they broke information down into smaller units. And depending on which layer of the OSI reference model, which we start talking about in Chapter 2... But we're going to talk about packets, which are actually the Layer 3 protocol data unit, which is the network layer. And I can see Sabahattin quietly squirming in his bedroom here as we go on about the ineffectual and horrific OSI reference model that is a nice thing to teach with, but doesn't really do a huge amount in the real world, but it will do because without that we don't have a framework to compare everything to. So... Now, when a message is broken down into packets, we basically get a number of benefits. The first benefit is that if a network is if message is broken into packets, the message doesn't necessarily have to completely monopolize the transmission medium. In other words, one call doesn't take up the whole circuit. You can actually multiplex multiple calls or multiple simultaneous communication sessions over one piece of communications medium. And in the digital world, this is called time division multiplexing. Has anyone got any questions or queries or comments on that stuff so far? And for poor old Mr. McMillan, if he has a flashback to 5 years ago, sorry, we'll take your question in a second, Steve, he will remember this stuff from CCNA1. Okay, go ahead, Steve.
Okay, I understand that the message or the traffic doesn't have to monopolize the medium, but at the instant where the packet is being sent, is the medium at that point, albeit for a very brief instant, monopolized?
It certainly is. When I say monopolize, I mean that the 100% of the medium capacity at all times is occupied. So if you open up a circuit, so let's say, you know, Mike calls up one of his mates in England or something on a circuit switch network, while they're talking about the good old days, that circuit is completely monopolized. Nobody else can use that circuit. And then when he finishes talking about, I'm not saying this is something he would actually do, but it's just an example. You can actually, that circuit is completely utilized. But if he's Skyping his mate in England, and he's also surfing Facebook, yes, the medium is monopolized for the time that he's actually sending the Skype packets and when his friend is actually talking to him, but it's not utilized 100% of the time because the Facebook packets can sneak down in between the voice packets and stuff. So you still see full utilization, but you see a more effective utilization of digital bandwidth. Because it can actually share it between a number of simultaneous applications. And I'll try and pick on all of you for examples as we go through this course so that nobody feels overly picked on with my silly class examples. Does that clarify that, Steve, kind of? So when the packet is being sent, yes, the link is utilized when the packet's going, but there are gaps between the packets and then there is time when things aren't being transmitted. Sorry, didn't mean to cut you off.
No, that's perfectly fine. I'm on the right page.
Alrighty. Anyone got any questions, queries about that? If anybody cares about quality of service and traffic control, I actually did a two-part series on it a couple of weeks ago. We talk about hierarchical token buckets and queuing disciplines and all sorts of other fun stuff as to how we queue and prioritize traffic. I'll try and get part two up onto the server today. But yeah, part one is already up in the Cavicasts folder, and if you're interested in that sort of subject material, it's not a bad listen. Okay, the other advantage of a packet switch network is that when the communication is actually sent, it's broken into multiple packets that contain source and destination addressing information. And the packets also become they often contain a sequence number. And the advantage of these principles is that with the sourced and destination addresses, it means that the packets can be routed over different channels. So if you have a failure in a particular circuit between two points, the packets can be rerouted a different way, and that provides fault tolerance. And the addressing information and the sequence numbers means that packets can actually be delivered out of order, which can happen if some packets travel over a higher bandwidth length than other packets or get there faster than other packets. The sequence numbers can result in the stream being reassembled in the correct order. The packets can also use all available network resources, and the bandwidth is more link bandwidth is more effectively utilized. Anyone got any questions, comments, queries on any of that? Okie dokie. And if you don't have any questions, feel free to type no into chat if you have that ability, and I'll move on faster. Because whilst I do take the gaps out of the recording afterwards, you guys don't have to sit for me waiting for everybody. Unless, of course, you do have a question, and then you can type it in, or type your name into chat. Now, the telecommunications industry wants to charge users for time, bandwidth, and resources utilised. I got a bit of a squawk from some Americans the other day when I said that given time, bandwidth caps and charging will come in America. And they're like, no, no, it won't, no, it won't. And I said, look at your mobile data networks. You get 2 gig of 2 gig of traffic per month to use on your smartphone, and then they start charging you. I don't know who the quote was originally attributed to. I could look it up in the Fortune file. But some very cynical fellow once said that solar power wouldn't become a world reality until somebody had figured out how to pass sunbeam through a meter. And I think that's sadly probably true in a lot of respects. You're all aware that resource utilization is obviously for things like power and water and all those sorts of things. Need I talk about power? That's a big one for people running servers and stuff and that sort of thing. How much power are you using? What's your carbon footprint, TM? The other thing is a lot of people believe that data should be free and you should be able to send as much of it as you want. But the harsh reality is that the amount of data capacity is finite, and by charging people for how much data they send and receive certainly limits how much they're going to send. In fact, I think a lot of the US residential services are limited to 200-250 gig. Is anybody on a smaller cap than that? Yeah, and to be honest, a lot of this need for bandwidth limitation and stuff, it can be argued that this has been caused by the file sharers. I know there are lies, damn lies, and statistics, but I read somewhere that 60% of internet traffic is BitTorrent, which is quite a high portion, which just goes to show you, look how good people are at stealing things. Some torrents, of course, are legitimate, but the majority of them are things like video, but most people torrent video. You've got YouTube and stuff, and that's probably a high percentage as well, but you end up getting a whole pile of video that's either torrented or the latest movies or that sort of thing. So yeah, 52% video, but a lot of that is actually torrent traffic and the latest release of whatever movie or whatever. So while some of us believe that Lady Gaga and Britney Spears really shouldn't be on the torrent networks at all because it's not good for anyone, that is certainly not the case. And I was on the train about a year ago, and I saw, and you shouldn't sort of draw stereotypes, but I saw these two women in their 60s discussing how to get BitTorrent running. And now there's nothing wrong with that, but I would have never expected to hear that conversation on a train, say, 5 years ago. Whoever said any of these statistics were fair, who even said that the RIIA or whoever they are were actually interested in getting the truth? They're just interested in proving that everybody steals movies and that it's hurting the industry, despite the fact that the people who steal the stuff probably aren't going to the movies anyway. Some systems use torrents. I think Leo Laporte was doing a vodcast or something, and he used to use torrents for his distribution, for his TV show. There are actually some independent record labels that are using torrents to get music out there to people. I'm assuming everybody knows what a torrent is. I don't need to explain BitTorrent, do I? Okie dokie, good. Go ahead.
I was meaning services like Netflix or legit video streaming services that might use in the background torrent type technology to stream from multiple locations. I'm wondering if that happens. It just seems like such a high statistic. I can't help but wonder if some of this more is being used legitimately than we think.
Yeah, it's difficult to say. See, I think that. Yeah, I think they use some torrent distribution for internal sort of distribution of traffic. But the problem with torrents is their configurability and getting all of the port forward configured. And it was kind of funny listening to these people talk about getting their BitTorrent set up. I actually had to sort of go, no, you as the network administrator must not enable these people to get their BitTorrent working because they are stealing things, and you should just sit quietly in your seat and not help them with their port forwarding issues as much as you'd like to. So yeah, TechNet does torrents, Linux distributions are torrents, some video stuff is torrents. I think Steam uses torrents. Blizzard Entertainment uses torrents to distribute its game updates. Things that require a lot of bandwidth and that can distribute the bandwidth load around the place are certainly using a lot more torrent technology than what previously used to be. And the final point here is quality of service, which is making sure the traffic that is important gets through, for example, your Skype and your VoIP and your TeamTalk and stuff, and your torrent traffic is considered bulk and given a lower priority, hopefully by you on your network, not by your ISP. There has been quite a history of ISPs shaping torrent that is traffic that is perceived to be BitTorrent. Now, in 90% of cases, they probably get away with this, but in the 10% of cases where it's actually legitimate traffic torrent stuff, that does tend to upset users a little bit. My notes are saying that if the demand for network services exceeds the available bandwidth, you can queue packets in memory, and they can be transmitted over the link. However, this does cause delays, and those delays can cause issues for technologies such as voice over IP, Skype, etc. If you don't have enough queuing space to hold all the packets that you're queuing, you drop packets and the packets are actually lost. And you've got three different types of traffic here. Like in my summary, you've got bulk traffic, interactive traffic, and time critical traffic. And if you actually look at the DSCP differentiated services code point, I think it stands for something. Model of bandwidth, you've got gold, silver, and bronze, and high, medium, and low, different priorities of stuff that needs to go through. And you need to balance the needs of the organization with the QoS. So, should web traffic be more important than that picture of the cute little puppy dog that's going to die in 3 hours at the pound unless you run down there straight now and save it, which has been sent out to all 100 employees? Anybody seen that? You get onto an organizational mail server with like a couple hundred people in the building, and somebody has to send a picture of a cute dog that is on death row to everyone, not realizing that 300 copies of the message is going to consume 300 times 2 meg for that pretty picture. They're also saying... It can be. And I must say, I do have a little bit of a raw nerve for people who quote about 10k of messages and go, ha ha, lol, yeah, and then hit send. That does tend to be a little bit annoying.
I did that early on the Linux list. I am so sorry.
Oh, it's okay. Like, the occasional one isn't too bad. What I really have a problem with is when there's like a 40k message and you go, yeah, me too, send at the top. And we go, well, that's fine, but did we actually need like the whole message underneath it again? So yeah, it is a problem. And I mean, obviously, administering a good mailing list and stuff is certainly a challenge. But it can also be a difficult thing to educate your users and say, look, you know, can you trim some of the quoting? And you really do get a lot of people who go, oh, no, that takes too long, it's too hard. And then for those people, you just set their moderation bit. No, you just ignore them. But we can dream.
It's a sore point for me, and I totally forgot about it. Like, oops.
Oh, it doesn't matter, it happens. The Linux list isn't so bad because there's only probably 10 or 15 subscribers. It's the announce and discuss lists that have 175 people on them where you start seeing the me too lols at the top of messages being somewhat of a problem. But don't feel too bad because my boss sort of said to me, oh, I can't email my Word document to everybody on the mailing list. The attachment limit is set to 40K. Can we raise that? I said, no, we cannot. And he's like, what do you mean we cannot? I said, no, we're not going to. I said, why don't you post a link to the document on the mailing list and they can all go download it themselves? Oh, suppose so. Okie dokie. And now we're talking about security here. We're saying loss of data, theft of intellectual property, misdirection of funds and resources, and all of that can be a result of bad community practices. You need to physically secure devices to prevent tampering, and you also need to secure data. Ensure confidentiality, in other words, make sure everybody doesn't get to look at your security stuff. Maintain data integrity, which means make sure nobody's actually fiddled with the data on its way through, and you use things like hashes and checksums and stuff to help assure data integrity. Make sure the data actually came from the sender. I'm sure everybody remembers, this was a long time ago, but does everybody remember the Melissa virus, one of the first Word viruses that emailed itself around with I love you, or something in the subject line?
I don't like that.
Yep.
Okie dokie. So, yeah, that was good. In fact, you absolutely. You're just like, wow, somebody loves me. No, it's just a virus hoax email. Okay, back to being depressed. Just kidding. You must have felt very special, especially when you had a couple of them come into the inbox. But the reality is that these viruses and stuff were quite prevalent, and the fact that MAPI is integrated into the whole Office suite and word processors can send email, well, I've always had a bit of a problem with that, but let's not get into that. Very convenient, but also kind of uncool if it's misused. I remember it was my ex-mother-in-law. Although somebody told me horrifically the other day that you never ever have an ex-mother-in-law, I pointed out that I did desperately believe that you could. She managed to get one of these Word viruses on the first day that it was out, and it was 5 minutes before she was about to update her virus definition, this thing ripped through her system and took it to pieces. So, moral of the story, everybody, try and let your virus software update itself on its daily or 4-hourly or 8-hourly or whatever schedule it's going to do, because it might just reduce the window of vulnerability to these annoying virusy annoying things. Ensure availability of resources so that users can do their work. That's probably doesn't need much
explaining.
Is email
scanning still the worst, or still the most popular thing, or are these web page scan viruses taking over?
I'm not sure what the current trends on virus infection is these days. My understanding was that a lot of it was now information stealing and web pages that look like your internet banking site and stuff. People were moving away from the classic virus per se, and they were looking at things like drive-by downloads and keyloggers and malware to load onto your computer that will then send all of your keystrokes to somewhere in China. Does anyone know what the metrics on that are? I'm pretty sure a lot of it is that hijacking stuff these days.
I'm pretty sure people have finally managed to beat the email viruses into people's heads enough now, so they had to change tactics.
Well, I don't think it was a case of actually changing tactics. I think it was basically a case of, well, why should we bother bouncing these viruses around the internet when we can just steal people's credit card numbers and buy stuff? Yeah, botnets and keyloggers and stuff. You know, nick somebody's credit card number and whatever. It's funny because, yeah, cross-site scripting, it's called, where you can inject other objects and pull things from different websites and stuff, all that sort of interesting stuff. We could do a whole course on that, but we're not, unfortunately. That would be fun and interesting, and I don't know enough about it. I was speaking to a student who had all sorts of trouble with PayPal. She said, any curiosity, has anybody had any trouble with PayPal and fraud in their credit card? I haven't yet, touch wood. And it's very important, guys, and I'm just going to say this just for the recording here, that you check your PayPal statement every now and again when you go on there. Look at the last 7 or 14 transactions or whatever, and make sure you understand what you spent them all on, because if something unusual comes up, you want to be able to do something about it rather than let that strange fellow that you've never met buy himself a PlayStation 3. The trends are more network devices, increased range of services, and an increased number of mobile users. Oh, well, this is good and bad. Am I the only one that sort of gets the feeling that so many people have got their face stuffed in their iPhone that in, you know, 5 years a classical party is going to be a thing of the past? We're all just going to sit and play Trivial Pursuit on our iPhones and not talk to each other? Okay, cynical mode off. Yes, Steve.
Here in the U.S., we had a mobile provider called Nextel, and their claim to fame is that they have a push-to-talk style phone service. A lot of taxi drivers and people like that use it. Anyway, they had a commercial a while ago that I remember chuckling over, which depicted a family sitting around like a dinner table, and although they were all around the same table, they were all chit-chatting on their walkie-talkie style phones, and I thought, you know, that's really going to go in this direction.
I don't know. It's one of these trends that sort of worries me to a degree. I think socialization is important, but you could actually talk directly to somebody rather than stuff your face into your phone and push to talk. But that's a philosophical thing that we could argue backwards and forwards, although I must say that on the way home on the train yesterday afternoon, I really did not appreciate this woman sitting up the other end of the carriage quite loudly explaining to the person on the other end of the phone and the rest of the carriage the current state of her dating, sex life, how many guys she'd been with, which ones she was going to be with, and suggestions to her friend as to which guys this friend would be with. So it's an interesting social phenomenon. And I'll be interested to see how, if at all, if that will ever be solved. Yeah, look, I always wondered about that. And I don't want to get too much off onto a tangent, but I see these people having domestics on their mobile phone on the way to work. Okay, you're allowed to have a domestic, but is nothing sacred?
Nope.
And then they get upset about Facebook or Google changing their privacy statements. I think that's hilarious.
Yeah, it's certainly a challenge. Sorry, go ahead, Cha.
I was just having this conversation with my husband. He said, can we find another mail provider other than Google because Google sniffs your mail? I said, you know what? It doesn't matter as long as it's online and it can be sniffed. And if somebody wants to go sniff my email and get the nitty-gritty details of my boring life, more power to them.
Well, I can see that this is potentially an interesting issue. The thing that occurs to me, though, is what makes you believe that any other email provider doesn't sniff your mail? At least Google is open about the fact that they do. And
that was my point.
That your email is being... Yeah, I used to work for an ISP, and there were legitimate reasons why I would go and look in users' inboxes, and I would ask them first. I'm like, look, I'm about to open your inbox and check for that big message that's stopping you from downloading your stuff. Is this okay? And they're like, oh, yeah, if you want to read my inbox, like, you've got less of a life than I do. Honestly, if you're worried about people sniffing your email, install GNU Privacy Guard and Enigmail for Thunderbird and do end-to-end message encryption. Problem solved.
I'm also of the opinion that if I don't want it on, if I don't want somebody to see it, I don't publish it, is my other thing. So yeah, they can go, because I don't send my credit card over email and so on.
Yeah, absolutely. We won't go into spam at this point. Spam is a whole kettle of fish, and I actually do have some other notes that I actually need to teach you guys this year, which is unfortunate because, you know, it would be interesting to talk about spam. We did actually have a talk, a CaviCast on spam in 2008-2009. Yes, it is. I think one of the only thing I want to say about spam before I move on, is please do not post your email address in an open format on a web page. That is one of the number one ways to say to the internet at large, please send me mail enhancement products at a cheap rate. Oh! Alrighty, any questions on the material in Chapter 1? Any comments? Anything anybody wants to say before we move on to the Chapter 2 content? Is this the point at which I mentioned that it's all going to be fairly cruisy for this next couple of weeks, and then I promise in about a week or two we will be converting decimal to binary and binary to decimal and hexadecimal and subnetting and subnet masks and stuff, so we are going to get a little bit more complex, but I'm just giving everybody fair warning that the first couple of weeks aren't too bad, although the labs in Chapter 2 certainly get you thinking about different things. Now, one thing I want to mention on the lecture recording here is that I've shuffled the labs and stuff around a little bit in on the website. You are looking at the labs in the chapter folders that have been modified for your use, and you are downloading and installing and utilizing T-Shark to do your labs. Well, most sighted people use Wireshark, previously known as Ethereal. We are using the text-based version of Wireshark, which is T-Shark, which is a little more flexible and certainly a little less crusty than TCP dump. Oh, you actually sniff your own network traffic as you do things in the labs, and you'll see that if you look in the Chapter 2 labs and stuff, you'll see that that's what eventually happened. But there is a version of T-Shark for the Mac, and there is a version of T-Shark for Windows, and there is a version of T-Shark for Linux. So pick whichever one you decide you want to use and use that one.
Yeah, if you go to wireshark.org, you can download the Wireshark, which also downloads T-Shark with it, and some other interesting goodies as well. But it will have T-Shark, and that can be used on command prompt on Windows.
Yep. Okay, I think I said in Chapter 1 that the network needs three things. It needs a sender, it needs a receiver, it needs a medium. Message is broken down into smaller pieces so it doesn't monopolize the network. I said that a while ago. This is called segmentation. Message broken into smaller pieces. Don't ask me why I wrote that twice in my notes, okay? We just, you know, don't judge me. Okay, we are breaking the message into smaller pieces. Twice, apparently. Two advantages, multiple conversations and multiple paths for redundancy. I've written redundancies here, so I'll have to fix that because that's not very good. Now, they're saying segmentation imposes overhead on network resources. That is to say that when we break a message down into pieces, we need to attach information to the segments or the packets or the frames that is over and above the message itself. So, for a silly example, well, not a silly example, but a real-life example. We look at, say, posting a letter. You don't just drop the letter in the postbox like you would with a postcard. The weather's here, wish you were beautiful. You actually put the letter in an envelope and you address the envelope and you post it off to your destination. Does that all make sense to everybody, apart from the contents of my postcard? Alrighty. Now we're talking about services that... services are programs that respond to network requests. Can somebody... You can either type them into chat or you can say them. Give me an example of some network services. Any examples of network services? We have ping. Yeah, email. I'd say SMTP, IMAP, and POP3. Email's a bit general. Yeah, SMTP, yep. How about the big one? Nobody's mentioned the big one yet that we all use every day. NNTP, yes. Yes, if you'd like to download lots of pirated whereas off alt.binaries.stuff.i.stol.from.my.mates. No, that doesn't actually exist. There are actually a lot of commercial online news services and people host... grab gigs and gigs and gigs of stuff off Usenet, the pirated stuff. It's sort of another, sort of one of those odd things. Like Usenet used to be quite popular, and now it's not so popular. But if you know which news services to sign up for and you have the right news readers, you can get all sorts of bits and pieces. So HTTP and HTTPS. Does anybody remember that attack? I think it was last year or the year before. FireSheep, where you could steal people's Facebook cookies and then log in as them. Yeah, that was interesting. So things you got to watch out for. And I'm going to—I don't know whether I recommended it last week. Really good really good password safe. KeePass. KEEPASS, www.keypass.info. You want version 2 and you turn on accessibility in the settings, and it's a very nice, secure, password safe, and it can auto type things into web forms and stuff, and it's all very nice.
Which version? 2?
Yes, version 2. Version 1 is more limited and doesn't have quite the level of accessibility. You do need to have .NET Framework 2 installed, but, you know, if you're running a Windows box without .NET Framework 2 installed, I'd be very surprised. Okay, we've got definitions of end devices. Computers, laptops, file servers, web servers, all those sorts of things. Network printers, VoIP phones, security cameras, mobile devices such as wireless barcode scanners, PDAs, iPhone, come on spammers, iPhone. End devices are called hosts. Hosts are identified by an address. Sorry, I was being silly. If you tweet the word iPhone, you get a whole stack of people offering to give you links to very cheap iPhones. And in my experience, the links never actually go to very cheap iPhones. Servers are computers that have software installed, and they provide information such as web servers, FTP servers, mail servers, all those sorts of things. And they tend to be bigger computers with more RAM, more disk, more reliability, backup power supplies, and some form of redundancy, you hope. A client is a software with stuff that's installed that helps you access bits and pieces from the server. So, generally speaking, a PC is a web client, and the place you talk to, like Google.com, has a whole series of web servers. No, I'm not talking about the web development people that have a web server installed on their workstation, okay? I'm talking about the people that generally run the client versions of software. Any questions on any of that? Okie dokie. Now for something completely different. Does anybody know how many IBM engineers does it take to change a light bulb? Okay, the answer is, I can't tell you exactly, but if you look in document number GC97416, the interchange of incandescent lighting appliances, you can find out. Okay, that was just something completely different. Now, intermediate devices. These are devices such as network access devices, hubs, switches, and wireless access points. Everybody knows what a wireless access point is. Does anyone here not have wireless on their network in 2012? Okie dokie, you've all got wireless. Okay, that's good. We actually had somebody who believed that having wireless in his house would cause all sorts of weird cancer and stuff. And my friend was stuck with using Ethernet over power lines for 2 or 3 years. And then this guy's wife got an iPhone and wanted a wireless network. And, you know, the cancer just so much wasn't a problem then, so the wireless network went straight in. Funny how these things work. Yeah. Yeah, but you're one of those security freaks, aren't you, that are terrified that, like, the bloke sitting outside your house is going to bust into your network and nick off with your collection of personally written poems? Okay. You and Pranav need to have a chat. You two can be paranoid together. That said, you should probably have some encryption enabled on your wireless network. However, I would possibly suggest that Kevin Jones's 47-character randomly generated password, generated by whatever that funny password site was that he has to copy and paste from somewhere else to feed into every device every time he wants it to access the network, is going a bit far. However, there were cases of people hacking and stealing wireless credentials and stealing stuff on wireless networks and that sort of thing. So you need to strike a balance between security and usability. If you're Sabahattin and you're alone in your bedroom with your wireless devices, okay, that sounded more seedy than I meant it to be, you can put whatever encryption you want on those wireless devices and that will be good. However, if your friends come over and they have to put in a 64-character password to connect, that might be not so cool depending on who your friends are. Okay, into networking devices such as routers. Communication servers and modems, I think we all know what they are. Security devices, firewalls, etc. And then we have a discussion on what those devices can do. They regenerate and retransmit network signals, maintain pathways about what data paths exist inside the internet work, notify other devices of errors and communications failures. Yes, your instructor has copy and pasted bits from the notes. Anybody who picked that up, you get like a free virtual lollipop. Direct data along alternate pathways if there is a link failure. Classify and direct messages according to QoS priorities. And if you're talking about firewalls, they permit and deny the flow of data based on security settings. Any questions on any of that? HTTP proxy would be a specialized network router devicey thing, I would say. But no, we don't specifically cover them in this particular section. We're just talking about general device types. It is possible to have an HTTP proxy built into, say, a firewall, so that's how we cover that one. Anyone else got any questions, queries, comments on any of that stuff? Okie dokie. Three broad categorizations of physical media: copper cable, fiber, and wireless. Has anyone not seen optical fiber? Alrighty, we'll assume you've all seen some form of optical fiber. It's sort of those thin couple of fibers in an outer sheath that holds them together, unless it's a really big, bundle of fiber, like you've got, you know, 50 or 100 or 200 fibers or whatever. And they've got this little subscriber, couple of subscriber connectors on the end of it. And you'll have seen a similar version of fiber if you've used optical SPDIF with your stereo systems. When you choose media, you need to consider the following things: the distance the media can successfully carry a signal, What sort of environment are you working in? Is it electrically noisy? Is it a rough environment? Is it a hostile environment? No, the Cat5 cable running through the room in which a domestic dispute is taking place is not considered a hostile environment as far as data communications is concerned, unless somebody's going to run along and stamp on your network cable. The amount of data and the speed at which it's transmitted, the cost of the media and installation. All of that makes sense. No questions on that, are there? Okie dokie. Excellent. Now, they're saying here that LANs are usually over a small geographic area. Don't argue with me about VPNs, virtual private networks, and how they're LANs over a big geographical area. We're not going into that. These are your little local area networks, like the one in your house, or the one on a particular floor of a building, or the one in the particular department of a building. So small geographic area, local area, relatively small. WANs are where you have multiple locations, usually separated by relatively long distances, connected together by telecommunications service providers. Internet is a global network of networks. I'm pretty sure we don't need to go into what the internet is. If you're not on the internet right now, then you're not taking this course. Okie dokie. Oh, I've got star, 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 which means this is where I got up to last year in this particular lecture. Anybody have any comments, questions, queries, etc. before we go on to ISPs? Yeah, all right. Well, we will not go into depth to ISPs. That would be quite an interesting anarchistic discussion and debate, which I'm sure would be far more interesting than these notes, but let's get through the notes. Terms to know. Oh, this looks as though it'll be handy. Hang on, I'm just going to drop my sensitivity down. It's cutting out a little bit too much. Okie dokie, that should be better. NIC connects the end device to the network, network interface card. The media will tend to connect to the network interface card. Physical port. Yeah, well, that's where the cable plugs in. There are physical ports and there are logical ports, so that comes in a little bit in a minute. An interface is a specialized port that connects a device to a network. They can either be logical or they can be physical, and we will go into logical interfaces at some point. And the notes are saying that there are specialized symbols which you don't actually need to know in this course. You just need to know that there's specialized symbols that people use for showing network devices and stuff. Has anybody seen like circuit diagrams, how they've got those international standard symbols for all the different things? Okie dokie. It says here the 2.2.4 lab is not accessible, so don't do it. I don't know why I wrote that in the notes, but 2.4 is not accessible, so don't do it. NeoTrace is a little bit tricky. There is a copy of NeoTrace on the website somewhere. I've got to actually sit down and write where NeoTrace is. Did anybody get NeoTrace to work? I usually just tell people to look at traceroute output, and whilst NeoTrace is quite nice, it's certainly a visual sort of mappy tool. Yeah, that was sort of my... You can use Control-Y to pull up information about the nodes and stuff, but it was just like... Alrighty. This is still cutting out too much, I think. How am I going for key up? Is it still keying down when it shouldn't a little bit? Alrighty, let's see what we can do. Oh. Alrighty, let's see how that goes. Okay. 2.3 protocols. These govern rules of communication, and the notes are saying give an example of face-to-face communication, for example. Hello XYZ, hello ZYX, shake hands, have a chat, have a coffee, have an argument, say goodbye, say goodbye. You know, example of generally socially acceptable protocols. Protocols depend on what factors govern communication. And a set of protocols that interoperate, we call that a protocol stack, because they all depend on each other, and also partially because there's a stack of them. Protocol suites describe the format and structure of the message, the method by which networking devices share pathways with other networking devices, so in other words, how you share routing information, etc., to tell people or tell devices which pathways between devices exist, how and where system error messages are passed between devices, the setup and termination of data sessions, and that is essentially some of the things that you find in a protocol stack. They're saying that some protocols can be vendor specific and can also be proprietary. Proprietary meaning that one particular company has control over that protocol stack. Has anybody been around in the computer industry long enough to remember IPX, SPX, Lantastic, Banyan Vines, all that sort of stuff? Bonjour. I thought there were alternate implementations of Bonjour. For example, what's that stupid thing called that I refuse to install? Avahi is an alternate implementation of Bonjour. Yeah, Bonjour is the, for anybody who doesn't know, is that protocol that goes and screams all sorts of information all over your network so that your Apple devices can communicate and discover each other and communicate without any end-user interaction. Well, yes, but certainly there are some security concerns to protocols that automatically configure themselves and stuff. I mean, how do you sleep at night knowing that these protocols are auto-configuring your devices in your bedroom on your wireless network? Just to be devil's advocate here. No, no, fair enough. I'm just raising that as a point. Steve?
There is an option on my airport router to enable, I think it's hard disk sharing via Bonjour to the internet. And I could see it being useful internally, but to the internet? I thought they might just rename that option, disable all security and allow everyone access.
It's just dynamic DNS to
I don't know where it would be useful, because if you're trying to access from another provider, that doesn't route, right? Like, yeah.
Yeah, I'm so sick of the cloud. Oh, can somebody please rain on the cloud? I'm so over the cloud. You know, 5 years ago it was all VPN, 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 and then it was intranet, 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 and now it's cloud, 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 cloud. Anyway, okay, I'm done now. What is it going to be next year? It's going to be an Uber cloud or something. And for all of us using Dropbox and stuff, yes, the cloud is useful. I'm just kind of sick of hearing about everybody saying that everything has to be in the cloud. I remember when we talked about clouds in 2005, it was going to be the thing that you were going to get wet when you walked outside because there was rain pouring out of the bottom of it. But if you are in IT today, cloud computing is somewhat important, unfortunately. I don't know, I just have a problem, and I've always had a problem with this. I have a problem with sticking all of my personal data in the cloud. This just doesn't seem like a very good idea from a security perspective. Has anybody actually read the Dropbox terms and conditions of use and realized that people have access to all of the data in your Dropbox, especially the people who work at Dropbox? Whilst I understand this and respect that in their terms of service, that does cause me a little bit of concern, or at least it should for about 90% of the blind population that do 80% of their piracy through Dropbox. Yes, I know. But I can guarantee that if you don't, probably 95% of Dropbox users don't pre-encrypt the data they store in their Dropbox, or Windows Live Mesh, or Amazon's S3 or whatever. Yeah. Does it actually, I mean, I actually haven't read the T's and C's for S3 because it's not something I use, but does it actually say in the T's and C's that, you know, there will be acts of God and stuff and we're not actually responsible for all your data, so if it all goes bye-bye, that's tough? Is that like in the T's and C's of S3? Yeah, that's sort of been my experience. Although, I think, and I haven't read all of it, I tended to find, and very briefly touch on this, Google's wasn't too badly worded for a privacy statement in TOS. They actually had some fairly common language in theirs. My suggestion to people, and I mean this cloud technology is very big, and this this collaboration and stuff is very important, and they're pushing a lot of this cloud stuff, and they're saying it's going to save power. They're saying it's going to be more efficient. They say your data is safe in the cloud. Am I the only one who sort of looks at this cloud technology and think it's a move back towards the mainframes when the control of our computing resources is actually taken out of the end user hands? Or am I just being over cynical?
First of all, encryption.
Yes, Steve.
You know, it reminds me, as many of the cloud services, S3 again, possibly Rackspace, charge based on how much data you're storing in the cloud. And admittedly, it's not usually a lot of money, but still, it kind of reminds me of the old CompuServe days where you had a storage space allocated and then you had to pay based on how much additional storage you used. I just see that coupled with the meters on data really putting us right back where we were in the 80s. Maybe the sizes will be bigger, but we'll be conceptually right where we were.
Interesting, isn't it? And back to thin-based clients, cloud apps. Let's take the computers off the desk and have good IT people. Where do you find those? Looking after all of your data and infrastructure, and you don't worry your pretty little head, TM, about where that data's stored. It's in the cloud. But the point I do want to make is, okay, this is an interesting point. There's certainly the convenience of the cloud, and I realise we've wandered off topic a bit, but it's kind of interesting. Except for convenience, why would you pay somebody to store 10 or 20 gig of data in the cloud when you can buy a 200 gig hard drive and just have a one-out payment and actually buy the drive and have it sitting on your desk? Buy a couple of them, stick them at your mates' houses, network it together and have your own private cloud. It's an interesting economy of scale.
Because if my house burns down, I still have it.
Except if Dropbox burns down, you don't. And they actually say in their terms of service that you don't. They don't guarantee anything. If you actually pull the Dropbox terms of service, they don't guarantee anything. They just make you feel as though you're safer.
True enough. That's why I tend to have one hard drive and one...
Yeah, well, one hard drive and another backup. Yeah, the key is, and what I see is a lot of people store their life in Dropbox, and they trust Dropbox to keep their data safe. Does anybody remember, I think it was about 100,000 or 200,000 users lost the entire contents of their Gmail? Does anyone remember that? I think that would have inconvenienced a few people. What do you think? Yeah, okay. So let's sort of move on. But yeah, and one of the interesting points it raised, actually, the loss of Google Mail, and it did come up in Windows Secrets, for anybody who reads Windows Secrets, is that you should probably keep your email and your email stores backed up, and that backups of your email and stuff are important, and your contacts and stuff. Okay, on with the rest of these notes. Sorry, we got a bit off track there, but A protocol can be technology independent if it specifies what needs to be done, but not how it's done, which means that the how can be different depending on the media and those sorts of things. Now, there's some benefits to layered models. The protocols that are designed in layered models can be designed so that they do specific things at specific layers. So, for example, the physical layer, you can deal with your voltage and stuff. The data link layer, you're looking at framing and your logical link control, those sorts of things, and they can be separated out into specific layered task-based stuff. The layers in a model talk to the layers above and the layers below the layer that they actually are. So, for example, if you're looking at the data link layer, it talks to the physical layer below it, and the network layer talks to it, and we will talk about that a little more in a bit. Fosters competition because protocols from different vendors can theoretically work together. Prevents technology changes in a layer from affecting layers above and below. Ethernet's a good example of this. You can run Ethernet on 10 megabit half duplex, 10 base 2 coax, or you can run it on 10 gigabit fiber. Provides a common language for describing functions and network capabilities. Any questions on that? Okie dokie. Is any of that stuff true? Yes, some of it is true. You look at the frame format on 10 megabit Ethernet is the same as the frame format on is the same as frame format on 10 gigabit Ethernet. So you bet that's true.
Layers must only concern themselves with.
Well, that's what the notes are saying us, and if Cisco asks you that in the test, you will dutifully tell Cisco that, yes, that does happen in the real world, and that the frame format on 10 megabit Ethernet is the same as the frame format on 10 gig Ethernet, and those things can interoperate. Okay, so the difference between a protocol reference model and protocol model and a reference model is the protocol model only shows you the stuff and how you get it to work with the protocol. The reference model shows you the whole virtual picture of how stuff is actually supposed to happen from a theoretical standpoint. There you are. There is the differentiation between theoretical and real world. So while you're anchored in protocol models, we're going to have a happy time in reference models for a little bit because it aids with understanding. Okie dokie. TCP/IP suite of protocols set by standards in public forum, request for comments. Has anyone ever not seen a request for comments? Or should I ask that, has everybody seen an RFC document of some description? Or at least heard of an RFC document, as far as TCP/IP is concerned? So RFC 822, for example, the interchange of electronic email. 1361 is network time protocol. There's a whole stack of them. No, it was 1305. Yeah, but they are a general series of documents that set down the internet standards. Okie dokie. Let's go back to our notes here. There are steps that protocols tend to take. Okay, this is OSI reference model specific, and we are in pretendy land. Okay. Creation of data at the application layer of the source device. Segmentation and encapsulation, in other words, breaking it up into smaller pieces and sticking the administrative information around those smaller pieces. And you do that to the data as it passes down through the stack in the source end device. Generation of the data onto the media at the network layer, at the network access layer of the stack. Transportation of data through the network through the network. Reception of the data at the network access layer of the end device. Decapsulation and reassembly, in other words, putting the whole stream back together and sticking it together in the right order on the end device. and passing the data to the application layer at the destination end device. Any questions, comments? Okie dokie. Types of protocol data units. Protocol data unit is what we call the information/data when it is at a specific section of the network, the layered models and the models and stuff. So we have data, which is the stuff used at the application layer. Segment is used at the transport layer PDU, Packet is the internetwork layer PDU, in other words, that's how we get stuff across networks. Frame is the network access layer PDU, and bits are what we use at the physical layer. Now, has anyone not heard of the 7-layer OSI reference model? Because we're about to do a little bit on that. Okie dokie. So, there are... there are a number of different reference models and a number of different ways of looking at data communications. For example, there is a 4-layer TCP/IP reference model and there is a 7-layer open systems interconnect model. Basically, what happens when you send data from a source node to a destination node is that the data starts at the top of the reference model, works its way all the way down to the bottom, travels along, and works its way all the way back up the other side of the reference model, in the reverse order, up the layers, to get to the end device. So if we talk about the OSI reference model, there are 7 layers. Physical, data link, network, transport, session, presentation, applications. Please do not throw sausage pizza away. There's a few other acronyms you can look up. There's a whole stack of them. If you want to remember it the other way, it's all people seem to need data processing, or Australia Post sucks, they never deliver parcels, is another one that you can use. So you've got, and by the end of this course, and hopefully in a couple of weeks, you will know the 7 layers. We have physical, data link, network, transport, session, presentation, application. This is something you need to learn. I don't care whether you play it on a tape to yourself 100 times, stick braille labels on the toilet door, whatever you've got to do to remember those 7 layers. We will be talking about them a lot, but you will eventually need to know those 7 layers and essentially what they do. Okay, the application layer, which is layer 7, allows the communication, end-to-end communication between users and their applications talk to the application layer. Layer 6 controls the presentation of the data, what character set, those sorts of things between different applications. Layer 5 is the session layer. It provides services to the presentation layer to control the opening and closing of communication sessions. The transport layer allows you to segment, transport, and reassemble data as it travels across the network. Layer 3 is the networking layer, which does the network level addressing and the transport of data over the specific network. Layer 2 is the data link network layer that controls the transfer of information over a common media. So, for example, the data link layer comes into play if you are working on Ethernet and you're working on a local area network, for example. And the physical layer explain the physical, mechanical, and electrical procedures that allow you to send the data and receive the data over the physical mediums, and they control deactivating and reactivating the medium and those sorts of things. Any questions on any of that?
What was that pizza acronym?
Please do not throw sausage pizza away. Okay, the difference between the transport and the network layer is the transport layer is responsible for packet order, packet sequencing, stream reassembly. In other words, if we get packets 1, 2, 3, 5, and 4, the transport layer is responsible for reordering them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 when it sees the end device. The network layer is actually responsible for the addressing of the different packets and actually routing the packets from source to destination. The transport layer makes sure that they get there in one piece and that they all get there, but the network layer makes sure that there are addresses and that they actually go via the right routes. So hopefully that answers that question, kind of. Yes, Steve.
When we look at something like a wireless network, I guess my question is that the network and the transport layers, to me, become a bit blurred.
Well, this is sort of where we get conceptual and real world and things don't quite line up. But what you've got to understand, if you look at it from an OSI perspective, is that stuff goes down through your application layer, it goes down onto your transport layer. Now, the transport layer is responsible for making sure that the packets get there from the right in the right order, and that they are sequenced and that sort of thing. You've got to understand that the wireless network has both a network layer which concerns itself with IP addresses, but it also has a data link layer which concerns itself with MAC addresses. Also, the wireless network has a physical layer which concerns itself with the actual radio signals. So, it is possible, for example, to have a wireless access point that serves two completely different IP subnets or two completely different wireless networks with SSIDs and stuff. So I would argue that the differentiation between the transport layer and network layer still exists quite significantly on wireless networks as well. If you look at the TCP/IP model, though, it's tend to be a whole lot more stuff that's lumped together. And what it basically has is it has a network access layer, which is responsible for getting the data from point A to point B. It has the network layer, which is responsible for the routing and stuff. It has the transport layer, which is responsible for the sequencing, the retransmission, and that sort of thing. And then it has the application layer. So some people are bigger fans of the TCP/IP layer because it has less layers, but a lot of people argue that it's hard to understand because a lot of stuff happens at the network access layer.
But data, for example, is segmented into packets, radio packets, independent of TCP/IP with beacon thresholds and so forth. Is that, even though that's dealing with data disassembly and reassembly, are we basically calling that the transport layer?
No. When you're dealing with radio beacons and stuff, that actually happens at layer 2, which is not packets, they're actually frames, and they're actually wireless frames, not packets, and they're actually network packets that are encapsulated into wireless frames, hence the different names for the PDUs.
Got it. Okay.
Yes, Mike.
Yeah, I was just wondering about functions such as security and QoS, whether they cover all the layers, and if so, would changing things in security violate the principle of the model?
No, security works in with the layered model, and security can be implemented at various levels of the model. So, for example, if you look at application layer security, that could be some encryption or something that happens in the transport layer that's invisible to applications. Or you could have transport layer security, or TLS, which happens at the transport layer to make sure that the transport units are secure, but the application doesn't tend to see too much of a difference in how things behave themselves. You can also have physical security, which happens at the physical layer. It just depends on how the security is implemented as to what effects it has on the various layers and what impact it has on either the user experience or the protocol. The protocol actually sending information through and what changes that makes.
Yeah, I think I see what you mean, although I'm thinking to myself that where you said before, if you one of the qualities of the model was if you change a particular, and anything that happens in a particular layer has no impact on other layers, and I thought, well, if you change the way that security is arranged, say in the physical level layer, then it could have implications for lower order or higher order layers. I'm just wondering how that, trying to think about it and think that there could be changes within a layer that would impact on how other layers need to operate on the packets or segments or data.
Well, this is theoretical, and this is what Sabahattin was saying earlier. He was saying that people would like to believe that all of the layers are independent, and this is the Garden of Eden of data communications, but the reality is that changes in some layers do impact other layers, and in the real-world TM, somebody's got to have a patent for it by now, there are actually interrelationships between the layers that affect things. So, yes, that certainly can be a discrepancy between reality and the theory of the whole thing. The OSI reference model is a teaching tool guaranteed to aid in understanding. It's not a rigid rule book on how we design and define networks.
Yeah, but it's always useful to understand the limitations and the assumptions in any model. Anyway, I'll let you carry on, Kerry. Thanks.
No. I agree with you 100%. And there are limitations to these models, and there are limitations to the way these things behave. And life is. Life is a metaphor, life is like a simile, not everything is like everything else, but we draw similarities between concepts to aid in understanding, and some of those things hold up and some of them don't. It's like saying sending a letter through the post is like sending a packet through the internet. Well, it kind of is and it sort of isn't. So, yeah, it's important to understand where these things, where the limits of these things occur, I agree. Now there's a section in here that is a comparison between the TCP/IP and the OSI reference model. This, I'm sure, will cause all sorts of debate and disagreement, but here's what they have. OSI layer 7 relates to TCP layer 4, the application layer. 6 relates to the TCP application layer, which is the presentation layer. 5 relates to the session layer, relates to layer 4 in the TCP model. I don't know whether I'd agree with that, but that's what they've got here. OSI layer 4 relates to TCP/IP layer 3 transport. Network layer relates to the internet layer of TCP/IP. And data link relates to TCP/IP layer 1 access, as does physical, and that relates to network access as well. So it's a loose comparison between the two models that does have some problems, but is listed in the notes to try and bridge the gap between the two models. And apart from any end of lecture discussion, I think that's where I'm going to stop this week. Any questions, queries, things anybody wants to say about the lectures so far?